Thank you for all of you attending today in Melbourne on the webinar and here in Sydney. I'm delighted to present a talk today by Pauline Blight-Johnston. My name is Scott Reeves and I'm on the Committee for the Leadership and Career Development. And Pauline's talk today is another in the theme of how one transitions from purely technically based training to how do you become a leader that's based on non-technical issues. Now, just some quick housekeeping, if I may. The standard, please ensure your mobile phones are turned off, or given that nobody ever does that these days, could you please at least switch it to silent? Secondly, I'm sure as a result of what Pauline has to say, there'll be hundreds of questions that'll occur to you. Could I ask you to do two things? One, keep them until the end of Pauline's talk, and two, just pop your hand up so that Liz can come around with a microphone. And that's important so people in Melbourne and on the webinar can hear the question you are going to ask. Okay. So Pauline is the Group Executive of Insurance and Superannuation, responsible for AMP's risk insurance, retail superannuation, investment, pensions and platforms business portfolio. During a career which includes more than 20 years of financial services industry experience, Pauline has held a number of senior executive posts in the life insurance, both in Australia and overseas. An active industry participant, Pauline is a fellow of numerous industry bodies. She's previously served as a director of the Australian New Zealand Institute of Insurance and Finance and is currently a director of the Financial Services Council. Pauline is also a director of AMP Life Limited and the National Mutual Life Association of Australasia Limited. I'd like to introduce Pauline Blight-Johnston.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you to everybody for welcoming me here this afternoon. This is an absolute pleasure for me. I was just sharing with Scott some of the challenges of my diary, which is one of the things I'm sure we'll talk about today. And as a result, it means that I'm actually not able to participate in as many conversations and speeches as I would like to do. But when this request came in, it went straight to the top of my list of things to make time for in my diary. And that's because I passionately believe in the power in this room and in doing what I can do to help others on their journey and what we can do for, really, society if we really harness the power in this room. So thank you for coming. We're on a journey together today. Having said that, given the diary challenges, this is not a highly polished speech, which is also another lesson of leadership, that there are times when it's actually more about who you are than about creating the absolute polish. So I've tend to bring this afternoon who I am. Nothing's off limits. You can ask what you want to ask. If I can't answer it, I'll tell you I can't answer it. And I focus more on trying to bring through, I think, the who-ness rather than the polish. So let's start. I guess I'll start by giving you a little bit of a summary of my career to date. I did my actuarial studies at Macquarie University, came out and started working for MLC in the corporate superannuation area, and very quickly qualified and went into consulting actuarial work. So I spent really the formative years of my career as a consulting actuary working for Tillinghast. I spent the best part of 10 years there. I took a slight detour along the way. I went and did a year's investment banking during that period and then came back to consulting, and we'll also come to the learnings from that period at some point in time. I went back to Tillinghast for a number of years. Then after about 10 years there, I left to join Asteron in the role of appointed actuary. I then took on the CFO function at Asteron as well as the appointed actuary function. From there, I did about 3 or 4 years there until the merger with Promina and Suncorp, and decided at that point in time the right step for me was to try a broader leadership role, and I was offered the managing director role for IGA in Australia and New Zealand. So that was my first role completely out of my actuarial field, so I took that position. I spent 6 years there. During that time, I had various global leadership responsibilities, including leadership roles in South Africa and in Japan. And then after 6 years there, about 2.5 years ago, I joined AMP, firstly to run the insurance business, and then 2 years ago when we had a group restructure, I inherited the expanded role, which has been a wonderful platform from which to really have an impact, I would say. So what I want to do today is go through, I guess, some of the stories that have made me who I am as a leader along the way. If I leave you with one message, which is often quite hard for actuaries, is that there is no formula for this. There is absolutely no formula for this. And a lot of what I say now would have frustrated me like crazy 10 years ago to hear it. So if it frustrates you, that's okay. Just sit with it. Because I would have said, tell me what I need to do to be a better leader. And what I'm going to tell you is you need to meander. There is no tell me what I need to do. You can't hunt it and shoot it down and just go for it, right? It's about learning who you are. It's about trying things. It's about playing. It's about the experience of life that really creates, I think, leadership. Sure, there are some techniques, but it's not a technique. It's not a textbook. It's not a course. It's really, and it's about being true to yourself. So one of my earliest learning experiences was, as I said, I became a consulting actuary quite young. I qualified quite young and very quickly decided to go to the UK. And so, because, you know, as you do, I had no commitments, so I went over to the UK. And I landed in the UK, a 23-year-old qualified actuary from Australia, young, female, all the rest of it. In the UK, they could not fit me into society. So those of you who will have worked there will understand what I mean by that comment. In a society that is very much, everyone has a place, and I had no place in a way. And being relatively young and quite confident, that didn't bother me. So I felt if I had an opinion, I could share it, and that would be well appreciated and valued. And that I had always been brought up, to believe that if you have an opinion and you don't share it, then that's worse than not having an opinion at all. People don't need to take it up. They can tell you no. They can tell you you're crazy. It doesn't matter. Okay, so first lesson, understand the culture you're operating in. So here I am sharing with all and sundry the benefits of my considerable or inconsiderable experience. Quite prepared to be told that, you know, just sit down and listen for a little while calling. But not closely enough watching the social cues. Until halfway through this experience, I kind of had enough intuition to know things weren't going very well for me. So everywhere else I'd worked, they thought, oh, the sun shone out of me, it was wonderful, blah, 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 blah. Here, it just wasn't humming. I could just tell this wasn't right. So I marched into the managing partner's office in the UK, and I sat down. I said, right, we've got a problem. I said, everywhere else I've worked, they think I'm great. Here, not so much. I'm clearly doing something wrong. I don't know what it is. But best you tell me, because if you don't tell me, I'm going to keep doing it wrong and keep annoying you. Of course, that was exactly what I was doing wrong, and he was completely incapable of telling me. And it was only several years later that I put the whole lot together and went, oh, uh-huh. So for me, there was a very, very early lesson in the in that adapting your style, right? So what I was doing in that situation was not being a victim about it. I wasn't sitting back whinging, oh, everyone hates me. I was actually trying to be proactive, trying to find a solution. But what I didn't do was adapt my style. I used the style that I knew. Now, anyone who's had any leadership experience or training will understand that we are who we are. Right? We're all individuals and we're all different, and that's what makes life wonderful. And there'll be some styles that come more naturally to us and some come less naturally. And typically when you're under pressure, the ones that come more naturally will come to the fore. And a large part of leadership is actually trying and playing with a range of different styles to be able to pull them out of your kit bag at the right point in time to have the right outcome. As my boss talks about, switching from auto to manual. So what times do I need to be something different here? Next, I guess, big a half moment for me was about 10 years later. It took a while. It was probably a little bit earlier than that. I went to Morgan Stanley, like I said. So in that 10 years that I was consulting, I went and did a year investment banking. And that was a fascinating experience because it was, again, not the right thing for me. Again, there are sort of two experiences in my life where things really haven't hummed. And again, I was in this environment that, for whatever reason, it wasn't the right fit for me. And of course, having always done very well at school, done very well at work, that was very challenging for me personally. I ended up resolving that situation by sitting down. It took a while to kind of work through that, but sitting down with management, actually going, you know what, this is not the right thing for me, and that doesn't make me a bad person, that doesn't make this a bad company, but this is not right for me. And again, years later, I've drawn on that experience to understand that as a leader, when you have people working for you, it's really easy, if they're not delivering, to be thinking, this person's just useless. Right. They are a good person, they are a bad person. They are good, you know, they're useful, they're not useful. The lens I always look at it through is this person in the right role for them? My learnings over the years from my own experience and from working with other people is very much that most people are pretty useful at something. Very few people are inherently good or bad. But if you put them in the wrong role, you're not going to get the best out of them. So that, to me, frees you up incredibly as a leader and frees up the conversation, because now you're having a conversation with somebody that says, I care about you, and I care about your development, and I care about you being successful, and I'm not sensing that you're set up for success in this role. What do we need to do differently to enable you to be all you can be? Very, very different from your crap at the job, how about you go find another one? So, another experience. The next big leadership experience I had was when I left consulting and went to be the appointed actuary at Asteron. And I was also given risk and compliance at the time. And that was 12 years ago, before risk management was what it is now. So there were no CROs or anything like that. So I was given risk and compliance basically to do in my spare time while I was leading an actuarial function. And I didn't have anybody, we didn't have the budgets we have now for risk, I didn't have anyone reporting to me. And I spent probably the first 3 months constantly letting people down with the delivery of the risk and compliance side of the business, because I had the actuarial function to run and we had to get the results out and there was all this stuff going on. And then I finally went, this is just crazy, I'm going to have to put someone in to do this job. So I went out and I found somebody very good, put them in to do the job, and I had this aha moment. This is where you go, oh, like, you know, how come I didn't see this before? All of a sudden, I was doing two things at once. I was running an actuarial department, and the risk and compliance stuff was getting done, and I didn't need to do it. And I know that's kind of so obvious in so many ways, but I just suddenly felt like, I felt very personally the value of leverage. That now I was physically, at the same time, doing two different things, and they were both being done, both being delivered. And that's when I had the aha moment about, my biggest aha moment about leadership. And that is that you might be very, very good at what you do, and I mean, you all are, or you wouldn't be in this room, right? Let's face that, okay? And most of you, and myself included, have gotten to where I've gotten by just working harder and taking on more because I have capability. And most of you will be the same, right? So it gets hard, what do? You just work harder. You've got that capability. But no matter how good you are, you might be good enough to do the work of 3, 4, or 5 people, but you can't do the work of 100. And the only way to really make a difference is to get that 100 working for you. And so that means you need to be something very, very different. You need to actually switch your whole psyche from what can I do, what can I get done, to how can I create the environment in which others are more effective. And that's my, as I said, leadership's a journey, and I myself go on these journeys and play with different things from time to time. My current thing that I'm playing with is very much every time I go into a meeting room, who do I need to be to bring out the best in the other people in the room? Because ultimately that's going to do more for AMP and AMP's business than me being a hotshot actuary or whoever I happen to be. So as I said, I feel almost embarrassed saying that was a revelation, but I think it was something that I'd always known intellectually, but until I really felt the power of it, it never really came home. And then I think from that point on, it's really been a continued evolution of that understanding for me. It's around who do I need to be to facilitate stuff happening, because the people out there will do a much better job than I can, no matter how hard I work. And I'd say, you know, one thing I think leaders often fear is the person who can do your job better than you. And I would say hire them and hire 10 of them. Yeah. Again, when I was the appointed actuary at Asteron, I hired an excellent deputy actuary. Really good. Like, I couldn't always keep up with him. And about 6 months in, I was talking to my boss, who was a CEO, who was also an actuary. I said to him, think I might have gone a bit heavy there. I don't think you need me. And he said to me, your job is to keep him happy and to find the next one. So again, that was a personal reflection on, hang on, I've got to reassess what my value is here. And I was actually going through a period where I was thinking, I'm not adding value here because he never makes a mistake. I'm not finding mistakes in his actuarial work. So what's my role in the process here? Well, actually, my role in the process is creating the leverage and the ultimate dream, really, for any manager is to have the whole system working for you and you put your feet up at the desk. That's my dream. I never wanted to work that way. But the most inspiring, the most energizing moments in my career have been when I've stepped out of business for a period of time, been on leave or had a baby or something like that, and I've come back and the wave has kept going without me. And I realized that for periods of time, I'm indispensable. Does have some slight challenges around relevance, but ultimately you think, hang on, this is what it's all about, right? That this momentum that we're creating in the business, everyone else believes in as much as I do, and we've now created this momentum, and we can do wonderful things. I think one of the best leadership lessons I think in life is being a parent. Now I know not everybody has that opportunity. Some will have it later, some won't, not everyone will have it in their life. But if you do have that opportunity or you have the opportunity to be around young children, I think you just need to remember people are just children pretending to be grown up. Right? Inherent natures of who people are really doesn't change from being children. And I think this is where, as a leader, when you're on a journey, I talk about meandering, you can find experience anywhere in your life. So if you think about those people with children, I always think about trying to get my kids to clean their teeth. So here I am, children clean your teeth, and they keep playing. Okay, kids, time to clean your teeth. Kids, can you please? Now off we go, right? Children, just clean your teeth! Okay, and then I drag them to the bathroom, and I'm there scrubbing their teeth while they're whinging and moaning and trying to get their mouths open. Okay, then I watch my nanny come in. Okay, she's like, right, kids, having a competition tonight. Who's going to have the shiniest teeth? But first, kids run in, clean their teeth, she's having a cup of tea. That's what management's all about. That's what leadership's all about, right? It's the same kind of thing. I have the positional authority at AMP to direct a large number of people to do stuff. That will be much less effective than them wanting to do it themselves. The outcome won't be as good, and it'll be much harder work for everybody involved. So, whilst you think as I go through the ranks, I get more power in some ways, in many ways you actually have less. In that you are much more dependent on other people choosing to do stuff. And now I find it quite challenging because if I'm questioning, say, the actuarial numbers or something like that, the pricing stuff, I actually don't have access to the systems anymore. I can't run the systems and can't even make the spreadsheets work to find out anymore if it's right or not. So I have to rely on others. Right? And if I want something done faster, I can't get in there and do it. I don't have systems access. All that stuff. So you really have to rely on others. So in some ways, whilst you get more power, in other ways, you actually have less power unless you have built the capability to harness that power and to have it work with you. There's something else I was going to say about that, but I can't remember. It'll come back. So for me, as I said, it's really all about, it's about believing in the people that work with you. They'll spot it if you don't believe in them. It's about being honest. It's about being vulnerable. And I think that's another key learning that you have. Nobody wants to follow somebody who isn't real. Okay. So one of the other challenges I think I've had in recent years is right around that, well, the people who are working with you want to believe in something, okay? So it's no good standing up there going, I don't know what we're going to do. I really don't know what we're going to do. That's not going to help anyone, right? Sometimes you might feel that, but that's not going to help anyone. But then there are other times when you know what the situation requires is literally saying, I don't think I've got that wrong. Because one of the big learnings in my life is every time I've said that, it's not like I was telling them any news. Right? But the relationship that that creates and the environment that that creates is so powerful. Because at the end of the day, I am never going to know as much as the combined knowledge of my team. Right. And I'm going to be much more successful if they bring everything they are to work every single day and try to make things better. And that involves telling me sometimes, Pauline, you did it that way, next time how about you do it that way? And if I don't create that environment, I'm not going to be as good as I am. But that's easy to say and hard to do. And you'll learn as a leader that there's a whole lot of stuff that people just don't tell you. And you say, I want you to tell me when I'm messing up. And they go, yes, yes, you've done a great job of everything. Right? It's a funny dynamic. It's a really odd dynamic. And it's not just a case of just paying it lip service, but you've really got to invest in creating that relationship. And you've got to remember how you react each time something happens that goes wrong. And things will go wrong. But how you react in every one of those moments of pressure will create the environment and tell your team 1,000 times more about how you will react when they make a suggestion to you than anything you ever say. And that keeping that congruence of what you're saying and how you're acting is very, very, very important. So I think I'll probably just wrap up with a couple of key learnings for me. I think one is, take away one thing, it's leadership. Developing leadership skills requires meandering. It requires trying different things on, and they will work sometimes, and sometimes you'll just feel like a goose and they won't suit you. What works for some people doesn't work for others, both from a recipient and from a deliverer perspective. So I would say practice at every opportunity you get, and practice different things. If it doesn't work, try something else next time, or try it again with a different people. And the best people to practice on are your kids, if you have kids. Every interaction is a learning experience, because at the end of the day, it's all about, whilst you may want someone else to do something different, the only thing you can control is what you're about to say, not what they're about to say. So how do I use what I'm about to say to create a different outcome in what they then do? And it's an art, it's not a science. So try it, practice on your kids. I think you've got to stay focused very much on really being interested in the people that you work with. Now, time is a real issue in business, and you know, I would love to spend a whole lot more time just having chats with my team, getting to know them even better, much better than I do. But I think as a leader, it's absolutely crucial. And again, one of the revelations I had early in my career was if I spent half an hour on a Monday morning wandering around the floor finding out how everyone's weekend was, the actuary in me used to say, Pauline, you've just wasted half an hour, you've achieved absolutely nothing. Now, if I then have 100 people who just feel better about being at work and are more interested in what they're doing, I've actually achieved a whole lot more than what I physically could have done in that half an hour. So it's investing in people, it's setting aside the time, and it's being very clear about putting in place systems to fill your gaps. So I won't naturally do that because I'm just always thinking a thousand things, and I won't always think right now is the best time just to stop and engage with people. So I put in place things in my diary and my support team to say, right, my EA puts it in my diary. Go and do this. There's nothing you need to be embarrassed about seeking help, and about particularly being very clear on where your gaps are, because no one's perfect, and putting in place processes and systems and people who are going to particularly fill those gaps. I would really encourage you to learn who you are as a person, because I don't think you can be an authentic leader and a leader people want to follow unless you know who you are as a person. Constantly challenge yourself on leverage. Am I getting the leverage rather than working harder and faster? And that requires time out sometimes. So one of the things that I do is I have a quarterly personal offsite day, and I hide somewhere. Don't go home because the kids are there. Don't go to the office because I'll get bothered. And I'm not telling anyone where I hide. but I hide somewhere, and I actually spend the day, and what I would do on a group offsite, but I do it with myself. Because if you don't put those breaks in the system, you end up being just on the rat race. And I would say overall, be real, be honest, and be vulnerable, because we are all flawed. People know it anyway. And we're all trying to get better together. And you get learnings from the most amazing places, but you're not going to get learnings unless people see that you're open to it and really genuinely see that you're open to it. So with that, I am now open to any questions.
So Liz will bring the microphone around. Are there any questions from the floor?
Hi. This might be a bit off topic, but I was interested in what made you move from role to role? What were you looking for in each of those roles?
Okay. I've never had a career plan, I'll preface this with. So at each time, when I'm presented at a crossroads, I make the decision based on what do I think I'll enjoy more? So two criteria I have. What will I enjoy more and what will I learn? If I'm enjoying what I'm doing and I'm learning, I'm energised and I'm real and I'm bringing my best to the role. And that's what brings out the best in me. And I have a very strong theory that if you enjoy what you're doing, you're good at it. And the people that go, I should do this because it's on my career path, are the ones that usually don't do the job so well. And for me, the investment banking experience was exactly that. I wasn't learning anything. It was, it's a very different culture, and it's all about, you know, putting in the hours, and I was brain dead. And so I actually did a pretty useless job at it because I couldn't motivate myself to do it. So that's my personal driver, is what I'm learning. The other thing, when I stepped back out of investment banking, by the way, my pay halved to come back out of it. The long-term financial trajectory has been fine because I've been doing what I've been good at. But for me, it's not about, I would strongly encourage anybody who's more motivated by the financial outcomes, again, to completely focus on what you're learning. If you learn and you grow as an individual, that stuff will all take care of itself. I think the people that focus on the short-term financial rewards, I think it's quite a short-term strategy.
Hi, Pauline.
Hi.
I'd just like to know, how did you juggle being a parent with your career?
Yeah. Anybody who thinks they're going to get the answer here, sorry. I would say I do everything in my life less well than I used to, and I have less time to worry about that. There absolutely is no perfect solution. The other analogy I use is I like to look like a supermodel and I like to eat donuts. And I have to work out where on that spectrum I sit. I can't sit at both ends. And being a working parent is a bit like that. You have to make trade-offs and you have to make choices in your life. There are a couple of things that I would say to anybody is whatever you choose, choose it. Because I do think a lot of parents, both male and female, carry guilt around with them and or victim sort of mentality around this is all I can do, so choose it. And there'll be times when you'll go, there are things I'm missing out on, did I make the right choice? But you have to actively own that choice or it will eat you up. You have to be realistic as well, and in both aspects of your life, get the best help you can. The advice I had was, if you're serious about doing this, and I was a managing director when I first had my first child, within international responsibilities, if you're serious about doing this, get the best help in. And you just have to accept that there are things you have to delegate. The other really good piece of advice I had was anybody can cook your kids dinner, but no one else can read them a story. So it's about, and I think the same is true in the workplace, it's about being there for the things that matter. What are the things that only you can do? And you've got to limit your time to the things that only you can do, and anything else you've got to set up other people to do well.
Hi, Pauline. Thanks for the talk. I'm interested to know your thought process when you have to make a tough decision. And what do you think about whether it's possible to be nice and also be a leader as well?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I nearly didn't become an actuary when I left school. I nearly became a doctor because I didn't want to... I was really interested in the whole humanity and doing something that would add value to society. And I really was quite scared that I'd have to become some horrible capitalist, nasty person to go into the business field. Fortunately, I did become an actuary because I don't think I'd be a very good doctor. For me, it's really core to who I am is doing the right thing and doing it well and doing it properly and treating everybody else with dignity and respect the way that I would like to be treated. And look, there are times when I've had to have tough conversations with people and I've gone home and cried at night. I can't cry in the office. That happens, right? It's real, okay? But at the end of the day, what I come down to is what is the right thing to do? I'm being asked to do something here. Now, if somebody's not doing in the right role for them, me continuing to sweep that under the carpet is not doing them any favours. And ultimately, I owe a duty to the shareholder and I'm not doing the right thing by them either. So it's not about me, it's about what's the environment here and what am I being called to do in this environment. But no matter how tough the decision is and no matter how hard the news is for somebody, there's no reason why they can't be treated with dignity and respect and treated as I would like to be treated in that situation. So for me it's always about, and I'm a very logical thought base, so it's always sort of, right, what role do I need to do here? This is what I'm being asked to do. or being asked to do, and say this is the right thing to do. This is what you know. It's not the right thing to continue to put things away because it would be an easier conversation or an easier decision. The other thing I'd say is I've always had a very, very strong bone integrity inside me, I'd say, and there are things I will do and things I won't do, things are really important to me. When I first went to investment banking, I thought, this will be interesting, this will get tested. And I actually switched sides in an M&A transaction when I went from Tillinghast to Morgan Stanley. I was working on one side of a deal for Tillinghast, and I flicked to the other side of the deal as I joined Morgan Stanley. And I was put in a room with the head of Asia, who sat me down and said, right, we want to know what you know. I said, I can't tell you. You know I can't tell you. And you know that what you know is that I would say the same thing the other way around. And, of course, they respected that imminently, and it was pretty much a test, I think, to be honest. But in that environment, I would just say, be true to yourself. And if they had said to me, right, you're not for us, well, then I wasn't for them. The other thing that I think is, I always say that I'm playing a bigger game here, particularly as a professional. So I found times in my life where it's been politically difficult. And I had one particular instance where I had to hold the line, and many of you all had this experience, right? You're the actor and you're the one saying no and everybody else wants to do it. And I had to hold the line. And I had somebody get a little bit, more than a little bit personal, and really go for me. And I just kept going, I'm playing a bigger game here. You can fire me. It's fine. I can get another job. I lose my professionalism. I'm gone. So for me, it's around that. Just remember that the game that you're playing here.
Hi, Pauline. At the beginning, you said it wasn't very polished. Let me assure you, it seemed very polished to me, so well done. Thank you. Secondly, I've had the joy of seeing feedback from past leadership forums, and one of the common themes from people sitting here has been, oh, I didn't quite get the how-to or what to do next or the plan. So right at the beginning, you said there is no formula. So you still gave us lots of valuable advice, which we appreciate. But if I was sitting here still thinking, oh, but what would be the steps to, you know, to transition from a technical role to a broader role, and you're going to say to me, there are no steps, just be prepared to meander, how would you get into my head, or how would you change my mindset to be just a little more open and to let go of the idea of a formula?
Yeah, wow. So look, it is scary, right? So you're an actuary. You know that with the same set of assumptions and the same formula, you're going to get the same outcome each time. Okay? Leadership is nothing like that. You can say the same thing in the same situation to 10 different people, and you can get one person loving you and hugging you and another person screaming at you and wanting to resign. Okay? People are funny things. So I think you have to open yourself up to the possibility, to the fact that you're going to get a lot more stuff wrong than you ever got wrong in your life before. And that's okay, as long as you treat people with respect and you're open to learning from it. I think the other thing that I did was I was interested, and so I couldn't stay in my box if I tried. So when I was the appointed actuary, I was really interested to know what was going on everywhere. I was sticking my nose in here, there, and everywhere else. And I think gathering that understanding, and you know, there's a great lot to be said for empathy. Now, you can't necessarily, I hadn't done their jobs, but to get the understanding of what other people are doing and how it relates and how what I'm doing is impacting them and how what they're doing is impacting me, I think was critical in getting the role in the broader leadership capacity. So I'd say definitely ask questions, inquire, be interested in people, be interested in what's going on, and accept that you're not going to get it right all the time.
Can I very cheekily ask a follow-up to that question? As a leader, if you could imagine a situation where you saw an actuary in your division who showed some signs of wanting to move beyond the technical boundaries, how would you help them?
The first thing I would do is ask them to help themselves. So, and that was for three reasons. One, it gives me the leverage and gives me a bit of time back. Two, it's a great learning experience for them just generally to always have thought about what could go next. But three, that process develops leadership in its own right. So it's particularly pertinent. So the first tool in any leader's kit bag when somebody comes with a problem is, what would you do? Right? Number one, and there's a reason for that, okay? Because it does develop people and gets them thinking. But I would say no more than in the sense of when they're thinking about leadership, because leadership itself requires you to think that way. So I'd certainly be getting them to think about those sorts of things. And then I would be encouraging them to do exactly what I talked about. Okay, what projects are you involved in here? So you're pricing, okay? So you're in pricing, and you're pricing our new risk offer, right? How much time have you spent with the product people? How much time have you spent with the underwriters? How much time have you spent with the salespeople? And use that experience that you're currently in to start to understand more about what other people are doing within the organisation. And I think that that would that'll make you better at your pricing job, as well as then start to create, open up your eyes and start to see. It's also really important to learn to interact with different types of people, and that would help all of that.
Hi, Pauline. Just a question about, I suppose, educational approaches to learning leadership. I mean, leadership is sometimes taught in business schools. Have you done any of those courses, and have you come across people who've done them, and what are your thoughts on whether, you know, there is anything that can actually be learned? I mean, I appreciate your opening comments that you think that there's no unique formula to it, but just, is there other central things that you think can be learned from these courses?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I've done a six-week course at INSEAD that I found very helpful, probably about 10 years ago. There are others that are more intensive. I think the trick with that, particularly as an actuary, is you can't go in there expecting that education that education experience to be anything like the education experiences you've known the rest of your life. So I went to this leadership education experience expecting the formula and some really good people to tell me some really good stuff, which should be really hard to learn, and I'd learn it and I'd be good at it. And I kind of sat there disappointed the whole time going, are you going to say anything soon? Well, that's blindingly obvious. I thought they'd be really smart. And as the years have gone on since then, I've realised what I learned when I was there, if that makes sense. So you've really got to open yourself up to new ways of learning. And I think many of those experiences, as much as anything, it's about the interaction, the trying different things, certainly the role plays, which I know most actuaries find, like, I'd rather pull my teeth out than do a role play. But that kind of stuff is a reason that all those things are in the training courses. And you do get a couple of bits and pieces out that can be helpful, some frameworks that can help you. I would say that there's absolutely a place for that sort of education. It can absolutely help you and provide some ways of thinking about things and some perspectives. And it becomes very valuable when you then tip the other stuff in, which is the bring yourself to it and start to learn yourself better. What a question here from the webinar. Thank you. Okay, I liked your comment, nice compliment, on choosing to do the things that only you can do and getting rid of the guilt, which most people experience for different reasons. I try to do that with myself. This is obviously a parent. I try to do that myself, but guilt still creeps in and overshadows the logic. Do you still experience that? Yes. How do you manage the guilt and conscious choices concurrently? One is you keep so busy that you don't have time to worry about it. But look, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You get your days, and I walked out this morning to three children who desperately wanted me to be there today. And I missed my son's first school fete the other day. These things happen. I've made it to all their Christmas concerts. So it really is, you know, if you're expecting to feel all the time like you've made all the right choices and there are no trade-offs in life, that's just not real. It is absolutely real. If it didn't happen, then I don't think you'd be a very good leader, because if you block yourself out to all your humanity, then you're not a good leader. So just kind of learn to embrace it.
Sorry.
Thank you, Pauline. I'm particularly interested for you as a female leader. We know how culture is encouraging female leadership. So I'm interested, do you see any difference as female leader, or do you see any challenges or strengths as a female leader?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, my theory on gender is pretty much my theory on diversity and on people, which is that every individual in this room has their own unique mix of skills and abilities. You've got some strengths and you've got some weaknesses. Some of those more commonly found in women, some are more commonly found in men, but typically we've all got a mix of strengths and weaknesses. And it's all about optimising the strengths and minimising the weaknesses, no matter what gender you are. So for me, what does that mean? It means I am probably genetically find it a little bit easier to read a room than some men, as in read when someone's feeling a bit uncomfortable. And that can be a helpful thing in leadership. I find it a bit harder to sell business down at the pub. So I have to find a different way of doing that. But I would say again, the women that I've seen do it well are very much like, this is what I've got, this is how I'm going to use it, the same as the men who do it well. I think the women who do it poorly are the ones who are like, oh, you know, it's hard for me because I'm a woman. And I think that that's true for both men and women as well. The one thing that I will say, I think I do still believe is very different for women, is the childcare. And I think the mission I'm on there at the moment is to try to free up the men, because my belief is that we're not going to get anywhere near equality till we make it more socially acceptable for men to make other choices with their lives. Because don't think that the choices that we are struggling with, our male colleagues aren't struggling with, but they're just conditioned not to show it. So I think for me it's about freeing that up in society, and I do still believe that all childcare should be tax deductible. But, yeah. Other than that, I certainly haven't experienced overt sexism in Australia. Experiences said people are different and different people have different challenges. I've had different issues overseas, but that's a whole different story. Did I have a mentor in the early stages of my career, and how do I leverage their support? Yes and no. So I've always been attracted to the idea of a mentor, but never really have developed one. Having said that, in the early stages of my career, I worked with leaders with whom I had very open relationships and great mutual respect. So I didn't feel like I needed to talk outside that relationship for me to grow. I could sit down and say, and I was, I guess, encouraged that too by being quite open, and I'd say, I don't think I did that very well. What can I learn from that? And we'd have a bit of a chat. And so that's kind of, I think, how I got most of my mentoring as I came through the ranks. I think mentor relationships are funny things. They can work sometimes really well, but I think probably more don't work than do work, particularly when you try to force the issue.
If I could just add a quick question. You mentioned, and I loved trying different ways, learning through example. Can you give an example where it failed and the learning from that?
I've got a shocking memory. That's one other thing. I let go of it when it goes wrong, which is really, it's really important, to be honest, because if you go around beating yourself up about it, you're not going to be effective for anyone. I'll do one where actually I tried to be more forceful. When I just took on the role of being managing director, and I had to get my first set of board papers out, and everyone sent them home with me to read the night before, and they were not where I wanted them to be, shall we say. And it was universal across the whole lot. And I came in the morning and I went, well, there's a couple of things I can do here. I can go around and speak to each person individually, and that'll take me all day. But we've only got a day to rewrite these papers, so how about I fire off a group email this morning? So I was in full flight, fired up a group email. Those in leadership positions laughing at this. Needless to say, didn't quite have the impact that I was after. So look, you do get it wrong. And the reason that I made that mistake was because I was thinking efficiency over humanity. Other times I've gone too soft on an individual. When I say gone too soft, you know, we're all people, and I'm sitting in a room and I can see somebody's upset and I have to tell them something that I know is going to upset them more in the short term. And I've gone too soft. And the ultimate end state has been hurting them more in the long term. Coming back to that other question. So it's tough. Actually, another thing too I'd say about trying new styles, one of the things I find is meetings. I really struggle with meetings, and anybody in AMP will agree with that. We have way too many, and they go way too long, and they're way too slow. And I'm a fast-paced person. I'm like, come on, we could have done this in 10 minutes. So there's a couple of things about meetings. One is you've got to understand that often it's about bringing other people along with you. So people have said to me before, particularly strategy meetings, someone said to me once, you and I could sit down and write this in 2 hours and not worry about the rest of them. I said, I could sit down and write it in half an hour. The reason that we're here is, yes, we might get a different strategy, but this is actually all about engagement. This is not about, you know, the content as much as bringing everybody on the journey. The other thing I find is I'm currently using the slow meetings to practice my leadership skills, because the slower a meeting is, the more time you have to think about who you're being at an interpersonal level. So to keep your brain busy so you don't say something silly because you're bored, I turn my brain on to thinking about the interpersonal dynamic in the room when the content is only taking a small part of my brain. And I use that as a learning experience.
Right. Well, that appears to be the end of the questions, and so I'll bring an end to the session. If you would join me, please, in thanking Pauline, not only for her time, but her wonderful comments.
Thank you.